Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll-free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now, with today's topic, here is James White.
And good afternoon. Welcome to The Dividing Line. 877-753-3341 is the phone number. Haven't had any phone calls in weeks, actually. Did we sneak one in somewhere? I think we snuck a couple in during one of the veneration debate things. But as soon as I start talking about Calvinism stuff, everybody just stops and just listens. They don't call anymore. We don't get, Arminians for some reason just don't. Well, other than Pierre, but I'm not sure the Arminians really appreciate Pierre's help. whatever. So now's your opportunity. If you've been saving them up during the past couple of weeks, I was riding this morning, and it still is possible to do that in here in Phoenix. You just do so before that big burning ball appears in the sky, because once it's up, then it gets really, really difficult to do. But I got in a 30-mile ride this morning, so I was listening to, and I made the mistake. I had found this sound file at home, and so I don't have the information here. I would have looked it up, because I'd like to know who this is, because he was talking about how he's been misrepresented. He's from Colorado. Sounded just like Sam Shamoon, but he's a Muslim. But he has the same, they sound very much alike. You know, people have similar voices. And he was over speaking in the UK, obviously a very conservative Islamic scholar, and an expert on fiqh in Islam. And he was talking about what we would call the ecumenical movement, or an inter-religious dialogue. And it was very interesting to listen to, because I think sometimes Christians need to be aware of the dangers of the enemy of my enemy is my friend type stuff. And I've certainly noticed this in looking at blogs that keep track of Islamic extremism, for example. I have a number of those in my RSS feeds. And in essence, I was just reading through one, and I come smack up against the fact that a lot of these folks are very strong secularists. They really have no more love for the Christian faith than they do Islam. They're very strong secularists. And that has to be kept in mind when you are looking at sources and things like that. And It is troubling, I think, to some people, but it is a reality that we should be thinking about, that a lot of these Muslims who are considered the most dangerous by the people who are speaking out against Islam, who are secularists, the reason they're considered to be so dangerous is because they're saying a lot of the same things that Christians say. In other words, I'm listening to this guy, and basically he says, now, you know, interreligious dialogue, when it is undertaken by people who are looking, basically you get Christians, Jews, and Muslims together, and we're all trying to find a way to agree with one another. And he says, I don't know why any believing Muslim would ever want to be involved in such a thing, because it would involve compromising the truth, and you're not going to get, I mean, we've been told what the Christians and the Jews believe is wrong. So the only way to come to some, you know, happy medium, some middle position, is to compromise the truth. So you no longer actually really have Christianity, and you don't really have Judaism, you don't really have Islam, you've got this mishmash of something that doesn't really resemble any of them and doesn't say anything. And I'm sitting here going, yeah, that's where I'd be coming from as a Christian. Of course, I'd be coming from there. And so we need to be careful, I think. I think sometimes people who get involved with apologetics, there really needs to be a balance, and you need to think things through. And not all of us ever do that perfectly, but think things through. A lot of the objections that I'm hearing being raised against Islam are objections that would be in many ways just as validly raised against believing biblical, solid Christianity. And that's something to think about and to keep in mind. I mean, I hear secularists, for example, they hear the Muslim talking about how a nation will not be blessed by Allah as long as it rejects Allah's law, and that individual Muslims will not be blessed by Allah as long as they refuse to follow Allah's commands. Now, of course, we would disagree as to what Allah's commands are and would argue that that the sources of information are using are inappropriate and invalid and so on and so forth. That's why you deal with the alleged prophethood of Muhammad and the Quran and things like that. But the fact remains that the idea that God has revealed X, Y, or Z, and that we are only going to be blessed as we are in obedience to what God has revealed, is not exactly something that the Muslims came up with. And the sad thing is many of the Muslims think that it is. And part of the reason for that is they're so accustomed to writing to Christians who tell them that they have basically no word from God. They have no law, they have no guidance, they have no revelation. I've heard Muslims in debates that I've attended and been a part of making the clear assertion that Christians have no law, they have no guidance, etc., etc. And that just simply isn't the case. But anyway, when we hear them saying these things, we can't be standing there next to the secularists going, oh yeah, that's bad. That's bad stuff, you know. Because if we would step back, we'd go, well, wait a minute, aren't we saying the same thing? Now, there are major, major differences, but the only way to really see the validity of the differences is to step back far enough to see where those differences are. We all believe that every knee will bow and every tongue will confess to Jesus Christ, but the means by which that's going to happen is completely different than the use of the AK-47 and the improvised explosive device by the side of the road. Or what we're seeing in England. I didn't get a chance to mention this. I should have brought this up on my screen, but I did not, so I could read this. But maybe somebody can pop URL in the channel once I start talking about it here. But about 5-6 days ago, the story broke of two students. My recollection was they were middle school students in England who were expelled or disciplined in some way, shape, or form for refusing to engage in a learning exercise. The problem is that the learning exercise was in fact praying the Muslim prayers. And so they said, we ain't praying the Muslim prayers. We aren't going to be bowing down with our faces to the ground and then standing up and putting our arms up like this. And I'm sure they had somebody demonstrating the way to do this. And of course, it's all in the context of learning about our brothers and sisters in a common humanity in our one big village and blah, 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 blah. But the students said, ain't doing it. Not happening. That's just not going to be something we're going to be doing. And they end up getting detention for refusing to do this. And it's just like, what on earth is happening in this world? I mean, it's just as bad as this morning. There's two boys, is what I'm seeing now on the screen. Thank you to Lane and Sue. I'm not sure if that's Sue or that's Lane or it's Lane and Sue. But I'm still waiting to get the phone call to do the marriage ceremony there. So, Rich just went, eh? But I'm making it known right now, if I get the phone call, that I will travel where I need to travel to officiate for Lane and Sue, because everybody knows it's going to happen. It's just, you know, that's how it is. But anyway, okay. Two 11 to 12 year old boys refuse to kneel and pray to Allah in, I think it's Al-Sajar or Al-Sagar, school, which is near Stoke in Cheshire County. The boys refuse to do so during a religious education class. The RE classes are part of an attempt to inculcate religious tolerance into the students. It appears to be a one-way street in this case. The students were forced to watch a short film on Islam and then told to wear Islamic headwear, kneel down on the floor, and pray to Allah in Arabic. Now, I have to admit, I was reading a book recently that actually Tim Challies reviewed and recommended, called Lone Survivor by Marcus Luttrell, a Navy SEAL. And he told the story about after being taken in by a Afghan tribe after he was severely wounded in the firefight that killed the three others in his team. Three Navy SEALs died. Marcus was seriously injured, and they killed 100 Taliban fighters in the fight. So don't take on the SEALs is the story that you learn there. But anyways, one of the elders from the tribe came in and in broken English led him in a prayer. And he wrote out, he could still remember phonetically what the prayer was. And it was the Shahada. And so he's just like, you know, he repeats these words and he missed one part of it, but I could tell what it was in Arabic. It's the Shahada. So all the little kids in the town or the village come running in excited because he's now no longer an infidel. He's a Muslim. And the elders of the village would come in five times a day and pray with him while he was there. Because, well, he said the Shahada, so now you're Muslim, see? And here in this school, they are having the kids pray a prayer that from the Islamic perspective makes you a Muslim. It's like, yeah, okay, that's good. This is the, yeah. Can you imagine what the Muslims would be doing if they had been forced to do something specifically Christian in these religious education classes? Ain't gonna happen. But this is the kind of stuff that is going on, and it's truly amazing. I'm seeing a conversation channel, I guess I caused poor Sue to scream very loudly and that it was in fact a in terror. And I'm not really sure what that means. I mean, is Sue telling me by this that she doesn't want me to come to her and Lane's wedding? I mean, that's very sad. I'm very upset now. So anyway, the real question today, especially in light of the Anglican Church's headlong rush into utter self-destruction that took place just a few days ago, is which is going to happen first? Will Islam just slide into the vacuum of the complete lack of anything in the UK? The Church of England is in just so much trouble and in such disarray that it's amazing. Or is Islam just going to, you know, take over? Which is going to be first? Will the Church of England collapse or Islam take over? Or is it just going to happen all at the same time? I don't know. But talk about a royal mess. Royal mess. I hadn't thought about that. But a boom. I don't know why I can't play sounds in Merc anymore. It really bugs me because I should be able to, but you know it won't play it anymore. I don't know why it is. Anyhow, so I have some sound clips queued up here, and then I have Converted to Islam, a man who is a convert to Islam talking about Gnosticism. I thought, you know, worst comes to worst, I can work through his video and comment on some of the things he says, because I think that's really important. That's important stuff. But we also have one brave phone caller, and that is, and when you're in where he's in Arizona, you're a true desert dweller. So let's talk with Doug. Hi, Doug.
Hey, Dr. White. Thanks for taking my call.
What's it like in your part of Arizona today?
Oh gosh, it's brutal. The clouds are coming in, and it's really humid.
Yeah. I'm watching the radar, and it's just like this huge insurge of lots and lots and lots of moisture just filling up the whole state. In fact, before I came in here, there was this wild, huge. We're talking, I mean, this thunderstorm that's to our northwest. I'm not sure exactly where you are in Arizona, but there's a thunderstorm to our northwest. And it's got all this yellow along its outer edge as it's growing, which is really weird. But the thing would be bigger than most states back east right now. It's that huge. It's really strange. I think it gets down here, we're going to get some serious rain. But anyhow, what can we do for you today?
Okay, thanks. I was talking with a friend today about the beginning of 1 Corinthians. And we were just kind of going back and forth. And we were talking about 1 Corinthians 3:2, the spiritual milk.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, What does that look like? Because I have a pastor who says the congregation is really immature, and so we can't talk about really difficult things. So they need spiritual milk, and they're not ready for, or they need milk, not food, not solid food. I'm just wondering what that looks like.
Well, there's two different kinds of immaturity. There's an immaturity that is marked just simply by being new Christians, and hence in need of basic and sound instruction. And there's an immaturity that's marked by what we see in Corinth, where you have petty divisions and you have arrogance and people rising up against other people and backbiting and all the problems and a lack of repentance for sin, for example, when there's sin in the camp. So there's two different kinds of immaturity that we might identify in that kind of a context. And so when Paul is writing to the Corinthians, he's writing in that context because he's going to be rebuking them for the major problems that exist within the congregation. But yeah, there's, you know, Paul will make a difference. He says, you know, for example, I wanted to know nothing amongst you but Jesus Christ and him crucified. But then he says, but we did, amongst those who are mature, speak, you know, in godly wisdom and so on and so forth. So the problem is, very obviously, when someone comes into a church, for example, people in the Founders Movement have to deal with this all the time. They come into a church, and often the means by which the pastor has come into the church might not be, from my perspective, the most biblical means, but you're there, you're now in that situation, and you want to begin the process of reformation. You have accepted a calling that clearly is going to require some work, and there's going to be some resistance due to tradition and things like that. It's a long process, but it has to be a process. It's so easy to give up eventually and say, look, you know what, we've gotten things to a point where things are sort of smooth. Things aren't really where they need to be. And, you know, Mrs. Finkelmeyer is still very much opposed to any kind of meaningful sound proclamation from the pulpit. But, you know, I don't want to upset Mrs. Finkelmeyer, so we'll go ahead and we'll stay at the sippy cup level for the rest of the foreseeable future. That, you know, that's a capitulation. It's one thing to recognize when you come in, okay, we need to start with the basics, we need to do some foundational stuff here, but there has to be progress. And that progress may well lead Mrs. Finkelmeyer out the back door, but if that desire is lost and the progress stops, that's when you have a real major problem, as far as I can see in a local church. And I see a lot of churches that get stuck there, quite honestly, because it's easier to stop waging the battle and just roll along and keep things happy than it is to press forward. And sometimes the purging that unfortunately has to take place when you come into a church that has been filled, sadly, for a long time with deadwood, the deadwood isn't going to go anyplace until you pull it out of there. And sometimes that's a very painful thing. So I think that's, you know, when he says, I gave you milk to drink, not solid food, for you're not yet able to receive it. Indeed, even now you are not yet able, for you are still fleshly. You are still focused upon the things of this world. There's jealousy and strife and so on and so forth taking place. That is, I think, relevant in recognizing that there is a basic level of Christian instruction, and then there is maturity. But just as you would never, ever, ever allow a child to continue at age 12 to be wearing diapers and using a sippy cup, and that would be considered grossly unnatural, the same thing would be the case in the church.
Okay, thank you.
Is that what you were looking for?
Yeah, no, that helps a lot, yeah. It's just that my pastor had said recently, talking about this, that, you know, the congregation wasn't ready for anything more, and they wanted to be wowed every Sunday.
Well, you know, he's probably exactly right. He lives amongst them. He knows that. The only thing that I would say in response to that is, well, that means this person has a real huge task in front of them, and it's not going to be an easy task, but there should be in place in that person's mind already a recognition of the fact that if they want to be wowed each Sunday, they're not there for the right reason. And I think anyone who's been in the ministry for any period of time knows that when the people want to be wowed each Sunday, you are going to have to, in essence, become the very description that Paul uses of the person who's blown about by every wind of doctrine to fulfill their wow desire, or they're going to be going someplace else. And the only way for growth to take place and a foundation to be laid is to let the people who are looking for the wow find it someplace else. And sometimes, you know, I fully understand the realities of paying the bills and staying alive and eating. But sometimes there's just no way around letting the driftwood drift to where the driftwood drifts. that's a rather interesting way of putting it. Never said that before, but, you know, driftwood by nature drifts. And, well, let's put it this way. A mature church, the people at a mature church should be there because they believe that Christ has called them to service in that place. And people who recognize that they are serving Christ in that place, that they are his servants, this is the place where he is worshipped, this is the place where the triune God is worshipped and his truth is proclaimed, people who come on that basis are coming to a mature church, but they're not going to be coming to a church where the rest of the people sitting around them just want to be wowed. And so stagnation is going to set in until there is a commitment that we are going to press through to maturity. We are going to press through to obedience to Christ over his church. And when you try to find a happy medium between no obedience and real obedience, that doesn't work. Not when it comes to the Christian faith, it doesn't. And you end up with stagnation, and you end up with people. And the worst thing is when it happens long enough, you get the driftwood in positions of leadership in the church. And once they have positions of leadership, I'm not certain that there's really much that can be done, to be perfectly honest with you, other than writing Ichabod over the door and getting out of there. Because I've seen it, believe me. I have seen where people who have absolutely no taste for the holiness of God and the things of God and sound doctrine and the whole counsel of God end up in positions of leadership, and woe be to the man who has to try to deal with those folks. It's about the worst position you can be stuck in. Okay?
Okay, thanks. I also wanted to thank you for your testimony posted on your church website, Why You're a Reformed Baptist.
Oh, yes.
My wife and I listened to that the other night, and, man, we're ready to pack our bags and move to Phoenix. Tell you what. Thanks very much for that.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I remember that was a summer sermon, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, maybe even longer now. Goodness. I mean, next year, 20 years at Phoenix Reformed, and this year, 10 years as an elder. And I remember when people would say things like that, and I thought, boy, they're really old. But now I'm saying it. So anyway, all right, let's take another phone call and talk with Ken. Hi, Ken. How you doing?
Hey, Dr. White.
What's going on?
I had a question about the Quran and Arabic and Islam. In your studies, since you've been studying Arabic and the Quran and all, in Surah 37, Al-Safat, those who set the ranks or the rangers, sometimes is translated, verse 107 or 108, depending on the Quran you have, it says, it's talking about the sacrifice of Abraham, where Allah says to Abraham, sacrifice your son, and verse 107, in Yusuf Ali, he says, we have ransomed him with a momentous sacrifice. And the word ransom, fidye, and I'm pronouncing it in the Farsi pronunciation, is pretty powerful there. It's the same word in all the Farsi Bibles for redemption, and that's used in Mark 10:45, that the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. But Muslims will say, I mean, to me, it's real obvious that the substitutionary sacrifice was there, but Muhammad didn't understand it.
No.
And there's a remnant of it there that's sort of underlying, but Islamic tradition and theology denies the need for substitutionary sacrifice.
It certainly does. As a fundamental aspect of their understanding, there's no question about it. I'm looking up the text, and you said Mark 10:45, and
in Arabic you're looking at?
There it is. And yeah, translating the Vulgate is redemption. I can't comment meaningfully on any type of pre-Islamic understanding of what ransom meant or anything like that. That's not something I have yet to tackle. But there's no question about the fact that the sources from which Muhammad or whoever else is involved in the compilation of these materials draws would have been rich enough to have informed someone much more thoroughly than the Quran demonstrates its author was informed of issues relating to redemption and substitution and atonement and things like that. There is indeed, from my perspective, a shockingly simplistic and shallow understanding on the part of Muhammad, especially for one who repeatedly argues that he stands as the pinnacle of the prophets, the last and greatest prophet, stands in this line, so on and so forth. Well, he clearly did not see how there was this deep line of sacrifice and redemption and ransom coming from Genesis through Isaiah, through the minor prophets, well, Jeremiah, then the minor prophets, and straight into the New Testament as well. And his ignorance of those things. And, you know, I know people like to sit around and go, well, what might have happened had there been a real solid Christian to, you know, open the scriptures to Muhammad? Well, you know, we can speculate about all those things that we want. Right. The fact of the matter is, what you see in the Quran, one of the many reasons that I could never accept and could never believe without sacrificing any commitment to truth in the Islamic religion is that Muhammad, if he was a prophet, would have understood these things, and he did not. He clearly, you know, if someone can, you know, make the excuse for him, well, he was illiterate, he didn't have access to the Old and New Testaments, fine, great, fine, wonderful, but anybody knows that he himself based his argument, if you read Surah 5, he bases his argument for prophethood on this line of prophets and the continuation of this emphasis upon the fact there's one true God. Well, okay, fine, but there's also the identity of that God as to what he has done. And if Muhammad had known the Old Testament, if Muhammad had known the New Testament, he would have known that the God of those prophets didn't just reveal a bare, barren monotheism. He revealed, yes, monotheism, but he then revealed himself as the God who redeems, as the God who is involved with his creation on that level, and so on and so forth. And he clearly did not see that. He clearly did not understand that. And as such, clearly proves to me he was not a prophet of God. And to be honest with you, given the arguments that Muslims use to promote the prophethood of Muhammad, I think that's a far more condemning observation than any of the proof that they try to give. That, well, you know, you have this consistency and none of the prophets ever said what Christians say and blah, 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 blah. When you really, really think about it, the fundamental message, the Quran hangs a U'i and not only tries to go back toward the Old Testament, and that's why you find so many Muslim apologists using Jewish apologetic materials and information, but even then it doesn't even approach the level that you have in Isaiah 53 or in Jeremiah, where you have this these redemption motifs that just they're just lost on Muhammad. They're just not there.
Yeah.
So,
well, what I've been wondering for years is, Muslims will say, intellectually, they will say, when I ask them the meaning of this, they will say, well, this is just a ceremony, because they have the Feast of Sacrifice
right
every year, and they slaughter sheep and goats and bulls and sometimes a camel. And I'll say, well, what is the meaning of this? And I'll say, well, we're remembering when Allah told Abraham to sacrifice his son.
Yes.
And I said, well, what's the meaning of it? And they go, well, we just do this and...
Allah knows best.
Yeah, well, and then we give the meat to the poor.
Yeah, right.
But
right.
Then you ask people that are not theologians, there's this feeling that the Muslims get that by doing this religious thing, this ceremony, it sort of makes them feel good, like they're getting points with Allah or something, especially when they give the meat to the poor.
Right, exactly.
Now, my question is relating to that, because I've seen people come from Islamic background and Baha'i background, and then, like, one guy came to our church, and he was Baha'i, and sometimes they want to take the Lord's Supper and think that they'll get a blessing from it.
Mm.
A lot of what you were saying before to the caller before, like in church discipline and stuff,
yes.
It was really difficult because I had to keep telling people, if you don't believe in Christ and that he is God and that he died on the cross and he rose from the dead and that he is God in the flesh from all eternity, don't partake of this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the Baha'i guy got mad at me because so I talked to him later. And he said, you're stopping me from getting a blessing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I said, you know what, though? You're more honest than a lot of people. A lot of people just ignore what I say, and they'll eat it anyway without any faith.
Right.
I said, but you actually, you took me seriously, and I thanked him for that. And you actually, and then later, other people, I mean, it took them a while, but because sometimes they let their kids, just happen. They think it's a snack or something.
Mm.
When you're dealing with a whole community that, in a mission context, where they're all coming from this other religion.
Mm-hmm.
And so, what is that like? Also, I'm trying to get a handle on what is that thing like Roman Catholics also putting money at graves, visiting dead saints, you know, the whole relics and rubbing something, thinking that you'll get power from
mm-hmm.
it. Ex opera operato, all that stuff. What is that?
Well, I think it's human religion. I think it is. We find so much connection between all of man's religions related to this idea that it is what we do that can control God's power. So amulets and burying statues upside down in your front yard to sell your house, and you know, the pantheon of saints, pantheon of gods, same difference as far as that's concerned. All of these are reflections of the false religion of man that says, well, look, I know that God is powerful. I can tell by looking at creation around me that he is. But I can't even begin to think about the idea of a God who is that powerful and yet is also sovereign. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to create mechanisms whereby I can allegedly control God's power. And that to me is the essence of human religion.
Yeah.
We see it, sadly, under the Christian rubric in many ways, and it even sneaks into what we would call true churches or sound churches at times, where people will slip off the narrow path a bit and start thinking that they can sort of control. Well, I know a lot of Baptists who think you can sort of, you know, by what you do, you're going to control God, in essence, by what you give, throw on the offering plate and stuff like that. But it's just part of human religion. You want to be able to do these things. You want to be able to control God rather than totally surrendering yourself to him.
Right.
And, you know, I think all of these things go back to that same thing. And the idea, and you're right, it reminds me really, and I don't want to get off that topic, it reminds me a lot of the day I was talking to a Jehovah's Witness on the phone. He had actually started calling me. I had been sending him stuff in the mail, and we were corresponding, and he called me on the phone anonymously initially, but then he introduced himself. And I was talking to this Jehovah's Witness on the phone, and he was well known. This was many, many, many years ago now. He was well known for his ability to argue against the Trinity, which is why I'd been put in contact with him. But one day I asked him a question, and I said, "Are you in Christ?" And it was amazing how uncomfortable he became, and how he basically just eventually just blew it off and said, "That's not important. Let's talk about something that's very important." And it reminds me a little bit of how the Muslims respond to the questions that you're asking them about sacrifice. Why do you do these things? Well, the shallow responses you get from people who otherwise would, you know, if you ask them a question on some very obtuse point of Sharia, they're going to give you a 45-minute dissertation on, you know, this school says this and this school says that. But then you actually talk about something really important, like why you sacrifice, and you get to the, well, Allah knows best level really fast.
Right.
And it really is fascinating to me that there are these huge blind spots like that in people's experiences. But they're there. They're very clearly there. And so I think you're right that you've probably got a direction to go there. Say, hey, here's a connection that I think you've missed, and that maybe even Muhammad missed, and as a way of presenting the gospel.
Do you think the man's religion is what Paul is talking about in Galatians 4 and Colossians 2, where he calls it the elementary principles of this world?
Well, I think it's applicable. I mean, there's probably a specific application in Paul's context that it is a religious thing, and yeah, it's probably parallel to it. There may have been a little more specific application that he was referring to that might have some connections to some Gnostic religion, religious ideas at that time. But yeah, it's those the fact that we're all created in the image of God, and when a rebel sinner who is creating the image of God is suppressing that knowledge of God, it comes out in certain ways. That's why Paul can have viceless, he can have sinless, is because, you know, he doesn't, that's not just what people in the Roman Empire did, but amazingly, those are the same things people in every cultural situation do, because that remains our primary connection. You know, when people ask what's the connection, connection that we should go for when we're talking to the atheist or anyone who is in rebellion against God. Well, we're all created in the image of God. That's where the connection is. And as a result, that's why you can make these true observations of human nature that transcend geographical boundaries and linguistic boundaries and cultural boundaries and time boundaries as well. So, yeah. All righty.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Ken. God bless.
Appreciate it.
All right, bye. 877-753-3341 is the phone number. That is the first time I've ever had to open BibleWorks and bring up my Arabic translation of the Bible on the dividing line, but I'm thankful to be able to do so. Have up on the wanted to get this one out here. Let's go ahead and listen to this. This was, again, James Swan does his listening to Catholic apologists thing. And he's kind enough to send me clips of various things. And it's always useful to folks, I think, to hear these things. And so here is a clip from our good buddy Steve Ray, Jerusalem Jones himself. One of... Hey, that's their terminology, man. Why? Wait a minute. How come the Roman Catholics get to call him Jerusalem Jones? And when I call him Jerusalem Jones... Hey, no, you're being me.
It still cracks me up to hear that. It's just so funny.
Well, he lives in that hat. So I've become jealous of Jerusalem Jones. So since Jerusalem Jones...
Yeah, but he doesn't have a whip.
Well, see, that's because you can't carry one on the airplane. Where he always lives. I feel sorry for the guy on that level. I mean, just on a personal level, this dude is in Israel more often than he is in the United States. He must have frequent flyer miles... out the wazoo. I mean, this guy has just got to be, you know, wow. He is constantly living out of a suitcase. I could not do that. My hat is off to him. Ba-doom, boom. But anyways, I've become jealous of Jerusalem Jones. And since he has that floppy fedora thing, I'm going for the Kangol cap look, man. I love my Kangol caps. And so that's going to become my, every picture of me is going to I'll have a Kangol cap on. Well, probably not. However, by the way, before I play this, Jerusalem Jones gets stumped by caller clip. before I do that, I do want to mention that if you have not, seen my YouTube page as of today, you need to do that. You need to go to the youtube.com/DrOakley1689 because as of today, I now am no longer limited to videos of 10 minutes and 59 seconds in length. And so now there's a pretty banner up there that takes us right to aomin.org and all the rest of this stuff. So make sure to do that. And let me mention something else. I was thinking about doing, you know, big announcements, and maybe I will talk about this more on Tuesday, put something on the blog about it. But let me mention this. I have the opportunity, as of right now, it's not written in stone yet, but it looks like between now and the end of November, I will be doing 6 debates with Islamic apologists that I have not debated before. And we're looking at 3 in the Southern California area in 3 days. So one debate the next day, another debate the next day, another debate. I don't think I've ever done that before, but they are on subjects. 2 of the 3 subjects that I have put out there are totally new and totally unique, and I came up with them because I think they will be extremely useful. These, of course, will be videotaped and made available, et cetera, et cetera. So we have that opportunity. Then the other 2, well, the third one, Lord willing, will be at Duke University in November before the Battle for the Truth Conference. And then here's where I'd like to encourage the folks who listen to The Dividing Line to step up and assist us. I know that my own church has already said that they will be helping with this as well. But basically, I need you to send me off to London. We have the opportunity. I would be going to Speaker's Corner, and I also would have the opportunity of engaging in 2 debates there in London. A church in London has a couple churches in London have already responded positively One even offering its facilities for one of the debates, which, by the way, is a big thing to do. Here in the United States, it's tough enough to get people to have a debate at all. But in London, especially given the Islamic population there, to host such a debate is, you know, there's a lot of churches that just wouldn't be willing to do anything like that. But obviously, especially given the exchange rate that exists today, getting to the UK is, and then putting your, you know, not wanting to be a burden on people, you know, just buying food, so on and so forth, and making sure that we get good videotape of these things and, you know, all the ancillary costs to go along with it. We're just basically looking to once again say to the good folks who support Alpha and Omega Ministries and the Dividing Line, if you would like to help to send me to London in November, what I would do is I would go to London. I would do these. In fact, you're going to have to be praying for me because we're talking about flying to London, doing two debates, doing Speaker's Corner, preaching there. Then instead of flying all the way back, arrange the timing so that I'm coming back to the East Coast and then doing the debate in Durham and then doing the conference and then flying back. And it also helps the jet lag, too, to cut it in half anyway. So you've only got the Atlantic to cover on your way back. So if you would like to be of assistance, you know, please feel free to hit aomin.org and to contribute toward that effort because it's not going to be cheap to do it, and but I think it'll be really, really useful. And I'm hoping that at least two of these debates will be with Muslims who will defend the standard. This is what's really exciting to me about this is that in looking at the range of opponents, we're going to be going basically, and I don't want to say this, I don't want to put it that way. How do I put this? We are going from the Muslim street. So in other words, what a lot of Christians would consider bad argumentation, but representative of the kind of argumentation that our brothers and sisters are being faced with daily on the Muslim street where Islam predominates. This is the kind of argumentation that they're going to be facing. And so that's why it needs to be responded to, and it needs to be responded to compellingly. And so some of the people I'm going to be debating, honestly, are not tasteful to me because they will throw anything, including the kitchen sink, at you. The idea of consistency, rationality, everything else goes out the window. And you know that I've debated at least one person like that in the past. But they're the ones that represent what our persecuted brothers and sisters are facing. And so we've got to deal with them. All the way up to one of the gentlemen that I will be debating, I have seen a paper by him against the deity of Christ, and it is without a doubt the most in-depth, best attack on the deity of Christ I've seen outside of the Jehovah's Witnesses. So it's the whole range, whole spectrum, and everything in between. So I'm excited. I'm very, very excited about all of that. Obviously, preparation for all of this in the midst of all the traveling I'm doing, all the speaking I'm doing, and the preparation for Bart Ehrman at the end of January means that we stay really busy around here. There's no two ways about it. But so that's what's coming up. I'm really excited about it. And so if you would like to help kick me out of the United States. Well, we're going to do a round-trip ticket, though, so I will be coming back, but at least for a while. Then please feel free to help support us in that, because that is something we could really enjoy doing. So that's coming up. So I've got seven debates between now and the end of January, and that's going to put me well past the 70-debate mark, because I'm thinking I'm somewhere around 65, 66. It all depends on what you count as a debate. If I counted debates the way some people do, I'd be in the 300s somewhere, but this will definitely expand greatly the offerings we have, especially in the Islamic area, and we'll be dealing with, obviously, biblical issues, especially the Trinity, and one of the topics that I've thrown out there that I've never heard anyone else debate is, does worship of the Trinity require you to commit shirk? And I can just hear the Islamic apologists chomping at the bit to get at that one. But a little bit slower, gentlemen. You might want to actually do some reading this time before we debate that subject. So I'm really looking forward to it. Okay, back to Jerusalem. Jones gets stumped on Catholic Answers Live.
As a convert to the Catholic Church for probably about 10 years now, kind of reading the Bible like yourself, I've picked up on verses and things like that that I didn't pick up years before of reading the Bible. One of the things that I have noticed, and this was always an argument in our family concerning the Eucharist, was the question of the word remembrance. And in Luke, that's the only gospel that has the word remembrance in it. And I was just trying to find out why Matthew and Mark did not use the word remembrance during the institution of the Eucharist.
That's a good question. I'm looking it up right now.
And I know that Luke was, if I remember correctly, was a physician, so he would have put a lot of study and time into it. And I've heard some arguments on the word remembrance, and so I was just trying to find out, like I said, why Matthew and Mark didn't feel the need to use that word, but Luke did.
That's a good question. Luke was telling the story that he had learned from. I'm not sure why they. Why? That's a good question. That's a very good question. So you got a couple of them stumped me here today, Jerry. I know that the word "do this in remembrance of me," what Luke wrote, is it comes from the Hebrew Old Testament, and it actually has to do with a sacrifice. There's the sacrifice of a remembrance sacrifice, and he's actually, when Luke is writing this, he's making reference back to an Old Testament sacrifice. Actually, all of the words of Jesus at the Last Supper there are very loaded. They're pregnant with sacrificial terminology. Even do this is a sacrificial phrase. It refers in many times in the Old Testament to offering a sacrifice.
By the way, let me just stop it right there, because somebody's filibustering right now. Somebody's filling. Stretch, oh yeah. That's what's going on. You know where I first heard this argument? We're gonna go back in the archives here for this one. It was Mitch Pacwa in San Diego during the Mass debate. This was his primary argument, was that when Jesus said, "Do this in remembrance of me," since he uses the imperative, it's a command, and that then becomes the foundation for the idea that the apostles were ordained as priests at this point so that they would have the sacerdotal capacity to work the miracle of transubstantiation, and this was all connected to the imperative in the Old Testament to sacrifice. So obviously there's lots of commands in the Old Testament. So since Jesus uses the imperative, do this, then that becomes the connection. And if you think that connection seems just a tad bit on the tenuous side, yeah, I found it to be that way too. But this is, when it's all you've got, you just sort of pass it around and other people repeat the argument.
But why Luke is the only one, I haven't noticed that myself. And I'm going to look that up, and I'm going to put that on my blog tonight as well.
Great, because that's always been my family coming from the evangelical side will always say, well, it says remembrance, but it's kind of like, well, you know, okay, let's remove the book, let's remove the gospel of Luke, and let's just look at Matthew and Mark. They say nothing of remembrance. They say, this is my body.
Well, let's actually try to do something positive here in the past and in the last 5 minutes, 4 minutes we have here, and that is the term. It would be nice if Mr. Ray would raise this, but maybe he does here in a second, I think. But the term is anamnesis, and in fact he does here just in a moment. But what he doesn't tell you is its uses in the New Testament. And I've those of you who've listened to my debates, Algo and Channel right now is starting to mouth this presentation, having heard it as many times as he has, but we have new listeners all the time, and so we have to repeat some things. But anamnesis is used here in Luke 22:19, when Jesus refers in the institution of the supper This is my body, which is given for you. Do this in as an anamnesis, a remembrance of me. It's then found twice in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Again, in the institution passage, do this in remembrance of me in verse 24, and likewise at the end of verse 25. And those are the only times it's used specifically in regards to the supper. But then it is used in Hebrews chapter 10, verse 3. And there it is, but in these sacrifices, and in the context, these sacrifices are the repetitive sacrifices of the old law. The fact that you had to come to Yom Kippur each year, and in coming to that day of atonement, the fact that you're having to do this again and again and again, in the repetitious nature of those sacrifices, there was an anamnesis, a reminder of sins every year. And then he makes the application, and you know, obviously they could not perfect anyone, because if they were perfected, then they wouldn't have to be coming back and doing this again and again and again. Otherwise, would they have not ceased to be offered, since the worshippers, having once been cleansed, no longer have any consciousness of sins? Hebrews 10:2. And so under the old covenant, you have repetitive sacrifices that become an anamnesis, a reminder of what? Of sin. But under the new covenant, 1 Corinthians chapter 11, where we have, this is my body given for you, we have the covenantal language, verse 25, this cup is the new covenant in my blood, do this as often as you drink it, in remembrance, anamnesis of me. So under the old covenant, repetitive sacrifices, the anamnesis of sin. Under the new covenant, what do we have a remembrance of but of the sin bearer, the Savior, who removes our sin from us? And this, of course, has been, for me, the key issue in speaking to Roman Catholics on this subject, is the fact that their Mass, since it is not a finished work of Christ, is not a completed work of Christ, it perfects no one. You can approach this Mass thousands of times in your life and die impure, have to go to purgatory. You can die as an enemy of God, having gone to Mass thousands of times. Since they don't have that completed sacrifice, they have a repetitive sacrifice. And what is a repetitive sacrifice according to Scripture? It's a reminder of sins. But those under the new covenant do not have a reminder of sins. They have a reminder of the Savior, and hence the difference in the usage of anamnesis in those times. So it's used four times in the New Testament, once in Hebrews 10 of repetitive sacrifices as a reminder of sins, and then the other three times of the singular sacrifice of Christ. And we do this in remembrance of him, not as a sacrifice to remove sin, but as remembrance of the fact that by his one sacrifice, he in fact has for all time removed sin. That is the message of the book of Hebrews, and that is the message that Roman Catholics need to hear as well. And so we didn't finish up Steve Ray's thing, but that's okay, because it's more important to talk about the biblical truth of the finished work of Christ. We will not be here next Tuesday. I'm headed to Houston. I'll be speaking starting Sunday evening. Reformed Baptist Church there speaking Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday evenings. And then coming back Thursday morning, so it's possible. You never know with airline flights and stuff like that. Possible. Might be here Thursday. We'll try to do it. If so, we'll see you then. God bless.
The Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again next Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. for The Dividing Line.